Vorab eine kurze Inhaltswarnung. In dieser Folge reden wir über sexualisierte Gewalt, Gewalt gegen Kinder und rassistische Diskriminierung. Wenn das Themen sind, mit denen ihr gerade nicht alleine konfrontiert werden wollt, dann würden wir euch empfehlen, diese Folge zu überspringen oder sie gemeinsam mit jemand anderem anzuhören.
Women can change the world. It's just about knowing that about yourself.
I think it's also very important to listen to yourself and to really believe yourself what you experienced.
Hallo ihr Lieben und willkommen zurück zu einer neuen Folge Frauensachen. Mein Name ist Judith und heute hört ihr eine etwas besondere Folge mit mir. Das hier ist nämlich unsere zweite Gastfolge. Für die habe ich mit Dr. Tandy Bombi gesprochen. Tandy ist Medienforscherin aus Südafrika und in ihrer Arbeit beschäftigt sie sich schwerpunktmäßig mit Gender-Based Violence. Das ist die Gewalt, die Menschen wegen ihres Geschlechts erfahren. Damit will sie einen Beitrag im Kampf gegen die Gewalt leisten, die in Südafrika besonders Frauen und Mädchen trifft. Außerdem ist Tandy Dozentin und Autorin. Ein kleiner Hinweis noch bevor wir loslegen, die heutige Folge ist auf Englisch.
Thank you so much for talking to us. Yeah, I'm looking forward to getting to know you and your work a little bit better because I already know that it's very interesting. Can you just introduce yourself shortly in your own words for our listeners?
I'm Dr. Tandy Bombi. I am a South African academic, so I teach journalism and media studies at the Wits Center for Journalism, but I've also been involved in various things. So I'm a researcher as well, and I do some writing. I haven't done a lot, but I have done some writing. And yeah, so that's basically me. My field of research and interest is listening. And gender-based violence in the South African context. I'm also very interested in gender studies, communication for development, and yeah, in my spare time I play soccer, and it's one of the things I really enjoy doing, so I have to always put that in my bio.
I knew about your writing, I didn't know about the soccer, so thank you for that. But yeah, as we already heard now, you do a lot and you already said that you're a writer. You write fiction and nonfiction and also poetry. So that's a pretty broad spectrum. Is there anything you are currently working on?
Well, okay, so I have been, there's this one piece of fiction. It's a creative writing fiction. It's a book, basically. I've been working on that for many years. And I took a step back from that when I started doing my PhD, but I'm really hoping to get back into it because it is a story that I'm very interested in getting out there. It's like mythical story, but it also touches on themes of womanhood and some of the issues that we have with gender-based violence. Yeah, so I'm working on that, but I'm also working on like other nonfiction type writing in the form of research at the moment.
Sounds very interesting, and I'm always very interested in like the writing backgrounds basically, because I also love to write. I have nothing published except for journalistic work. Can you tell me a little bit about when you started writing?
Honestly, I actually started writing when I was very young. I think the first thing I wrote that I can remember, I was like 11, so in grade 5, and it was a short story, and I shared it with my English teacher, and she was so encouraging. She was like, oh, this is very lovely. I don't know if it was actually lovely because I don't have it anymore, but she was so encouraging that I just kept writing, and all throughout high school, I would write. I wrote a few plays that we performed at school as the school plays. You know, and I used to write a lot of poetry as well, because I think as a teenager, life can be very tricky. And I think I used poetry as a means of expression and sort of understanding my own emotions and also like helping me understand the world around me. And I continued with poetry throughout university, And then later on, in the later years of university, I started writing fictionalized stories that are based on reality, but also that's also when I did long form writing and creative nonfiction.
I also remember writing very early on in my childhood, just because it felt like a very natural form of expression to me. You already touched on you writing poetry. That's like a whole different category again. So what exactly drew you to poetry?
I think when I was younger, I used to love rhyming, which at first, that's what I thought poetry was about. I thought that if it rhymes, then it can be a poem. So a lot of my early poems are very much all the words that rhyme. But it also, it's like a short and I would say impactful way of really just getting things out. And it was one of the ways in which I loved expressing my emotions. So what would happen is if anything happened, I would write a poem about it. And then when I would read the poem, I'd be like, oh, this is what I'm feeling, or this is what I think about this thing. And so if I look at some of the poems I wrote when I was younger, I can actually remember the things that were happening. So if I had a crush on someone, I'd write a poem. I remember my best friend. We've known each other for about 17 years now, and how I introduced myself to her was through a small poem that I sent to her. Yeah, it's like just a way to express my emotions, good, bad, scary, all the emotions through poetry.
Yeah, I think that poetry is a very good way to do that because it's so condensed in a way. What are topics you usually deal with in your writing? Like, you've already kind of touched on that you focus a lot on the experiences of women, but would you maybe want to expand on that a little bit?
Sure. So yes, the experiences of women, that's like the main thing. That's like the umbrella. But then, you know, the experiences of people who've had their voices sort of marginalized, people who haven't necessarily been given a platform to speak, you know, so I have focused on the voices of young people, youth. So that's also, it's not only female or woman or, you know, gender nonconforming people, but in my later years, it's mainly been women, particularly women who have experienced some form of violence, whether it's like structural or, you know, economic or even, you know, like gender-based violence. And so one of the short stories I've had the opportunity to get published was actually, it was part of this project where this woman from Zimbabwe, she interviewed a few people who were child brides, and she used those interviews to generate short stories, and that was such an interesting process, and it also got me interested in talking about child marriage, which is a terrible thing and terrible topic to actually get into. So mainly that and the experiences of women. Because I am in journalism, that's one of the things that I teach, the experiences of women journalists. And yeah.
We've already heard right now you're dealing with very serious and also moving topics. What are reactions to your writing, positive and negative maybe?
So when I first started writing, I was very public. So I would publish opinion pieces on the experiences of women. And there was one incident where I publicly critiqued a very like powerful public figure in the South African context, very respected. One of the views he had held was that he didn't engage with black women who had their hair in a particular way. So my piece spoke out against that, and it was basically saying that I'm a bit disappointed that such an influential person can really just dismiss people because of something so superficial. And one of the experiences from that was, you know, there was quite a lot of public attention, and you know, some people thought it was brilliant and amazing, but you know, obviously there were some people who weren't as nice. They were very rude, and they said things that I didn't expect to hear. I was also very young. Well, not that young. I was in my early 20s. I think after that experience, I chose not to publish as much online. In fact, it's shortly after that I stopped publishing on my blog, but my work shifted from sharing it in that way to like more publishing it in different ways and academic spaces. So the feedback obviously is different, you know, and I don't have to actually engage as much with like the online stuff. So yeah, I don't have like recent experience of like online engagement. But when I did, I mean, it was quite mixed. You know, there's people who will agree with your ideas, then there's people who won't agree, and then there's people who will be really mean for no reason, or like point out things that aren't necessarily related to what you've written about. But that's also just, I think it's the society we live in, but also it's also what happens these days with online participation and engagement, you know.
Yeah, I think that everyone who's kind of in the public eye has to get used to some form of scrutiny. Especially if you share your opinions, there's always going to be people that disagree with you. I think that's also something that you kind of have to get used to as a journalist, especially if you deal with topics that are emotionally charged or somehow polarizing. But is there a favorite piece of writing that you have done? Maybe could you like name one?
I think that piece was one of my favorites. Like I said, it was an opinion piece, but it just made me feel so empowered, because it was kind of what had happened was there was a news article that was published about this person refusing to basically take the photo with me. In that moment, it felt like a lot of power was taken away from me. And when I wrote that piece, I felt empowered, and I felt like, you know, actually, you know, the way I look and the choices I make with how I dress, how I wear my hair, all of these things are not essentially who I am. I think who I am is a lot more than that. And I think that engaging with me as a person will always be more valuable than just judging me according to what I look like, or, you know, what you think the choice for my hair is. So I love that piece because it was a point where I was speaking out against things that even today I really still believe that we can't just judge people according to the choices they make. And I think that women, men, anyone, gender non-conforming people, we should be allowed to do whatever we want with our bodies. I think that, you know, we live in a society that tells us, you know, what is beautiful, what is right, you know, what, you know, we should be looking like, what women should be saying. And I think that if we can speak out against those things, if we can like say, actually, this is who I am and this is what I like, then, you know, all I feel be a lot better. But the reality is that not everyone gets that opportunity. Not everyone has the platform, and definitely not everyone will be listened to in the same way.
We've already made it clear that you focus a lot on the experiences of women. So I think maybe we could give some background here on like South African history in general and why this topic is so important. So apartheid ended in the 90s, and I'll give a short explanation of apartheid just like for the listeners. apartheid was basically institutionalized racial segregation, and it was an incredibly discriminating system against non-white people. And after apartheid, the first democratic government in South Africa was formed in 1994. And according to the South African constitution, men and women are equal and possess equal rights. The laws on gender equality are actually rated quite progressive, but this is not really reflected within society and the working environment. So how would you describe the role of women in society in South Africa at the moment?
One of the things that is important to note is that one of the systems that we had was apartheid, and before that, we were under like colonial rule, and some of the structural violence from those times, even after we moved into democracy, they remain. So there's inequality in education, there's inequality in the resources that people have. Gender dynamics in South Africa, even after democracy, even with the very strong constitution that we have also been quite unequal. So we still see very, very, very high rates of gender-based violence, intimate partner violence, violence against children, violence against young girls, and it's almost embedded in the cultures that we have, which is very unfortunate. And I mean, and by cultures, I don't mean like specific cultures related to specific people. I mean like everyday cultures, like things like catcalling or the things that happen when we see violence. There are areas where people do intervene, but it's not common for people to feel like they should intervene if they see something that is bad, you know. And it's also the way in which we perceive women in the South African context, and the level of respect afforded to women and their voices. So even though we have a very strong constitution and the government, and there's lots of civil society organizations that are working daily to change the situation, we still have people who believe really, really toxic things about women. In terms of the situation that we're in now, we just also have high rates of femicide. The research that I did was looking at the way in which we understand gender-based violence and how we listen to it. So one of the findings that I found is that the way the media, so journalists, report on it doesn't give us enough to empower us to start to see it as a structural thing. You know, we look at it as individual cases, we look at it as a specific thing that is happening outside of our area of sight. But if you look at the statistics, it's happening every single day. Almost every woman that I have come into contact with has had like some form of violence be enacted upon her. It happens in workplaces. So it even happens in newsrooms, and it happens at differing scales. And I think one of the things is we only are outraged at some of this violence when it leads to death. So when a woman has died, but even then we, you know, after a few weeks, we go on, we pretend that we didn't hear anything about it. A lot of the time people want people to be arrested and jailed for violating women and killing women. But that's like after the fact, you know. If you arrest a person who's killed a woman, the woman will still have died. We don't have enough going into trying to find preventative measures. And that goes back to education, it goes back to the norms and the values that we instill in young people. You know, by the age of 10, a lot of children have already seen violence or experienced it in some way. And if that's the case, then obviously it becomes embedded in the way in which they perform their lives, and it's already too late. So, yeah.
To give some numbers maybe on this topic, Gender-based violence is a massive problem in South Africa. According to Human Rights Watch, the rate of femicides is 5 times the global average, and it also is estimated to have one of the highest rape rates in the world. President Ramaphosa called violence against women and girls the second pandemic in South Africa, next to COVID. Is this role, you talked about how it's very systemically embedded, is this also connected to the apartheid system?
I mean, it is and it isn't. If we think about how violence operates, then you can make links, and scholars have made links a lot. It's that we've become used to violence. It's that through various forms of oppression, we have come to expect violence in our everyday existence. So even if you're outraged at being violated, people will be like, but that's how it is. That's what we know. And I think in that way, it is very much related to apartheid, because we're not afraid to see people violated. You know, these things have been embedded in our society for lots of years, and even before apartheid, you had like the way in which black women were treated during the colonial period, where their bodies didn't belong to them. So even to prove that you've been like raped or violated by someone, you know, who's a different race or who's white, for instance, was really difficult, because they didn't see that as a form of violation. And I one of the things that emerged in my own research is that, like, when people were talking about like some of the atrocities that took place during apartheid, you know, women weren't socialized into thinking of rape and gender-based violence as one of the atrocities that was related to apartheid, even if it was inflicted upon them by like soldiers or like the police, or like, you know, it just wasn't considered. And you know, the way in which we look at gender-based violence now is also related to like, you know, the UN definitions of like what it is, and how governments actually like start to view certain things as atrocities, and that changes over time.
I think that just goes to show that like violence is a cycle, and it also shows the damage that these unjust systems do, and that it's not just something that vanishes when the system is abolished, but it like really shapes a society and the people that live in it, and takes decades and generations to undo. Focusing on your own research again, you have done research in the field of media and journalism, and you've also focused on gender-based violence, and your PhD work, which you already mentioned, dealt with listening in the face of gender-based violence. Can you maybe explain what exactly listening means in this context?
Yes. So basically, listening in the way that I imagine it and the framework that I developed for my PhD is more of trying to look at the structures, so the history and also the cultures, so like patriarchal cultures, and what they tell us about how we are supposed to understand violence, and then try and listen otherwise, which is listen beyond the prescriptions of our history, beyond the prescriptions of our cultures. So if you go into a situation where you are supposed to listen to someone, you're not looking at what they look like, where they come from, or like how the categories in your head that already tell you how to understand them, you're going to try and actually hear what they're saying outside of those categories. So for instance, if we have a news story about a rape, for instance, because there's so many, the rate is so high and it happens to so many people, editors and journalists choose which stories to focus on. So usually they choose stories that are related to mainly middle class, beautiful, and like public figures. And if we try and listen otherwise, we won't just see it as a problem or a pandemic when it's happening to women who look like that. It happens every single day to women who don't look like that. It's happening to children. It's happening to gender non-conforming people. A lot of patriarchal culture does not actually teach consent. So the way consent is even understood, if you understand it within a patriarchal context, you don't see a no as no. I mean, and this isn't just a problem in South Africa. You know, you have songs and TV shows that teach us that we can't trust women when they say no. So listening otherwise is actually trusting a woman. If she says, no, I'm not comfortable, then you hear it the first time. You don't wait. You don't try convince her. You don't believe that her no means yes. And you don't believe that she's playing hard to get, right? You just believe that she's saying no. And it goes all the way to if someone says that they've been violated, instead of trying to understand why they would be lying or what it is about their reputation that makes them a liar, you would just say, this person has been violated. Let's investigate that. Because I think one of the things that happens if you don't have like a dead woman is that people just say it didn't happen. She's trying to tarnish someone's reputation. What was she wearing? You know, what signals was she giving? Is she like promiscuous? Is she innocent? You know? So all of those things actually stop us from hearing and listening when things happen. And basically the framework that I developed is supposed to try and help us like remove all of that and remove all of that other noise and actually hear, you know, things for what they actually are.
That's super interesting. I also think that in this context, listening to ourselves is very important. Like, victim blaming is a real thing, but it's not always external. Victims blame themselves very often and start to question themselves because of these messages. I think it's also very important to listen to yourself and to really believe yourself, what you were feeling and what you experienced. You've already mentioned your communication strategies that were developed to combat gender-based violence during your research. Can you give an example of one of these strategies and how it works?
Okay, so the framework is like, it has a few elements to it. If I just have to like give a summary, an important aspect of it is creating space. So you have to create space in order to listen. And it's also very difficult to just listen out of nowhere, right? So creating space is important, whether you're listening to a friend, whether you're listening to yourself. Like, sometimes you have to like be away from the noise in order for you to have that process. And another aspect is also recognizing that what is being communicated and the person communicating to you might be something that you're not expecting it. So you shouldn't already have an idea of what you're going to hear. So you must recognize that the other person is a different person from you. Whether you will or will not understand what they're saying is also up to what happens. So you must create the space. And sometimes you are going to engage with someone who's very different from you and someone you might not necessarily agree with, but if you take up the responsibility to listen, you need to create a space for that conversation to happen. You need to have the capacity to listen, right? And you need to be honest with yourself, do I have the capacity? So once you have recognized them as an other and you've created the space, you need to actually sit with them and engage with them, allow them to say what they have to say. You're not listening so that you can respond, which is something that happens so often. You're not listening so that you can tell them why they're wrong or why your idea is better. You're just allowing them to say what they need to say. But I think after you have created that space for them to talk, one of the things that I found was very important is creating a listening symbol. So your listening symbol depends on like the context. If it's a friend who needed to talk, you can hug them. You can respond with your own thing, but you, this is after you've actually given them the space to say everything they need to say. If it's at a police station, then a police report that actually takes into consideration what they've said, you know, so it depends on the different contexts, so a listening symbol, and then reflecting on like what that listening space has given the both of you. You know, if the space was created because I needed something to change, then the listening symbol will also reflect that. It will show that we are building something towards the change that I'm looking for. But that's an oversimplification. I'm working on shortening the framework into like a book, so that's also going to be available at some point. But yeah, that's how I would suggest one listens otherwise.
I think that would work very well in many contexts.
So it's not only limited to interactions that have to do with gender-based violence, but because I worked on it with this in mind, it's very sensitive to that. So it's also sensitive to like maybe the needs of people who need to speak and need that space to be listened to.
Yeah, that's very relevant that it's also given then in this context. You are doing research, but you're also getting in contact with like real people, real women, and very personal stories. Even in my own research, I kind of felt that weighing on me and also during our conversation, and I didn't dive in nearly as deep and extensive as you did. How do you cope with that emotionally and personally?
Well, it was really difficult during my PhD. It was very stressful. And I remember there was one day where I was just so sad because of the stories that I was reading. You know, I was just crying as I was writing. And so it's not like I was just like, oh yeah, you can run, you can do some exercise and you'll be fine. It is a heavy topic. I think the idea of capacity is actually, it came from myself. Because there were times where I had the capacity to do my research, and then there were times where I really didn't, and I needed to take time off, and I needed to get away from it. The reality is that this is a problem that is way bigger than me, which is also important when you're doing this kind of work to realize. So if I take a week to just, you know, relax or like understand my emotions, get some therapy, or, you know, as long as I need, the world will still be what it is. And I would say the same for you, you know, or anyone working in any field. One of the things that did help is talking and applying my listening to different contexts. But a lot of this, you know, there was a section that I had to write that was on love, which was so nice. It was like so freeing and fun and interesting. You know, part of my thesis was looking at the problem, but also looking at possible solutions. But it's also important to like not just immerse yourself within one thing, to do different things. That's also why I like playing soccer, because it's like, it's fun and it's like very physical. You don't have to talk to anyone or listen. Well, you do. You have to communicate with your teammates, but it's not as heavy. So I would just say that each person needs to find the things that help them feel safe and comfortable. And you're allowed to stop and take a break and see if you have the capacity to do something. And it's very okay if you don't, you know. It's also okay if you've had the capacity for like a long time, like 4 years, and then you decide for the next 2 years you're not going to focus on that, you'll do something different.
I think a sentence that will kind of stick with me is the world will still be what it is, even when I take like 1 or 2 weeks off, because I think that's very true. I think it can kind of help to carry that load of such a heavy topic to, like you said, remember that it's really not that about you. Your expertise is media, so maybe let's talk about that a little bit more. South Africa is ranked fairly high when it comes to press freedom. According to Reporters Without Borders, as of 2025, it's ranked 27 of 180, so yeah, that's pretty solid. It has a pretty diverse media landscape, and press freedom is also protected by the constitution. There's a lot to say about like the media landscape and journalism in general, but I would say we focus on the women here also, because that's also like the umbrella topic of our podcast. What is the situation for female journalists in the country?
Yeah, our constitution is very protective of journalism and media. And we also have the South African National Editors Forum, and they do so much work that is very interesting and incredible to protect journalists. But again, in any society where you do have gender inequality, it plays out in different ways. So one of the things is, in terms of ownership, we don't have a lot of women at the very top. So that's one aspect. And then also, as a journalism lecturer, I see a lot of journalism students that are female. And it doesn't always translate to those women going into the field as journalists. Or, you know, if they do go into the field, maybe they stop after, you know, a junior level. I mean, there are some interesting and amazing journalists out there, female journalists in South Africa. But then one of the research articles I wrote was about like the strategic gender-based violence that is enacted on women journalists by like mainly political parties and political figures who use the woman's gender as a way to attack them when they don't want to respond about certain things, or when they don't want to deal with certain things. And one of the things we found with that research is that the supporters of those parties are also responsible for a lot of like online harassment and that kind of stuff. And I have this friend who is a journalist, and she's actually an investigative journalist. She's also told me about her experiences as an investigative journalist, where, you know, people have her number and they call her and they threaten her, and, you know, sometimes she has to like take a step back because, well, she's very strong. She's very like intense, and she will go there. But, you know, she's been put in positions where, you know, she felt a little bit unsafe because people had her number and people were saying things online and accusing her of all kinds of things. And I think that's the case for, like, even male journalists. But because there's that gender-based violence aspect, women probably feel more threatened. And sometimes that is a make or break factor. As to whether they stay in the profession or not.
What are some necessary steps to improve the situation for female journalists, like specifically?
So like I said, the South African National Editors Forum, SANEF, they do a lot of work to protect journalists. And there's lots of court cases. They've actually done court cases against some of the political parties and the leaders who've been aggressive. You know, the newsrooms themselves also can be very protective over the journalists. But obviously with harassment, you know, it happens, and sometimes you can't even police that. Yeah, I think the work of the South African National Editors Forum is very important. But, you know, scholars working in gender studies, even having courses in universities where people are studying journalism to help them understand gender equality, not just the woman, but like everyone, you know, is important, because then that gets them thinking about gender as something that they have to think about when they get into the workspace.
Studying journalism is like the perfect segue right now, because you're not only a successful academic, but you're also a lecturer at WIT Center for Journalism. So what does it mean to you to be able to teach journalism?
So I've actually been teaching for about 7 years now, and it's one of the things I enjoy the most, because you engage with different people and you talk about certain things. part of teaching is also learning quite a lot from the people who you are teaching as well. So yeah, for me to be a lecturer is very special. I feel like it's a point where I get to also share myself and my expertise, but my vulnerabilities. And I get to learn a lot from the people I engage with as students.
Is there anything that is especially important to you when teaching journalism?
I think that critical engagement with the world around us is like important. The media has such an important role to play in our society. It helps people understand the way the world works. It also helps people make very important decisions about how to be in the world. So that's one of the things that I would love my students to understand, that it's not just, you know, it's not just going to be a fun experience. It's like a huge responsibility, and you have to be passionate about what you're reporting on. And not everyone is cut out to be an investigative journalist, but there are areas that we're drawn to. Understanding what you're drawn to, the kind of work that you love, and the kind of work where you can pour yourself into it, even when it's like really difficult, is where I would say that people need to like focus on and do that kind of work, understand it and understand their own contribution. Because I think every single person I've ever taught has had a beautiful and unique contribution to make in the country and in the world. And I believe that about, you know, everyone I meet and every student I meet, even outside of South Africa. It's about understanding yourself and understanding where you'll make your contribution, and just being happy with what you can do as well. Because if you like nurture that, then so many amazing things can happen.
Yeah, it is a big responsibility and also a big contribution. And I think that's an ongoing pattern with journalists, that it's often not that easy to have this separation between work and life, because so many of the things that come up in your work are also things that you're passionate about in your private life, and the other way around. You've mentioned that there are many female students in journalism classes. Do they have gender-specific fears or problems in your experience?
Not like specifically, no. I mean, no one has gender-specific fears when they go in. When I was like a student, I was just like, I didn't think that because I was a woman, my experience of journalism or the world would be different. But obviously the world kind of teaches us in different ways that this is something you have to be more concerned about, this is something that you have to think about. And I think that the only way really to ensure that you support these students is to have sort of classes that also talk about gender and talk about structures and talk about how it can be a little bit difficult. And what happens when I include a gender aspect in my classes is that, you know, the students have other experiences outside of the classroom that then they then bring in, and then they start to reflect on those based on some of the theories that we engage with. And they're like, oh, okay, well, that's probably why that happened, or, you know, that explains that experience that I had.
Yeah, I think many women aren't that concerned with being women until they're basically taught that other people are very concerned with them being women. But I think that can also be a strength when you don't put yourself into that role automatically and you're aware that it's not necessarily your place, or that the place that other people put you in isn't necessarily your place. I think the situation is a difficult one, but there's like an ongoing struggle and there's much important work being done also by you. I think like in general, the whole research aspect of this topic is very, very impressive. Could you maybe share some of your hopes for the future in this context?
Yeah, I just hope that we see some changes being made. I really hope that the way in which we report on violence against women improves. For the one article that I'm working on now, I saw that there's It's like a special project that one of the news organizations is doing on reporting on children, or reporting on violence against children, not just girls. But it's so interesting, the work that they've done, like the different articles that they've published. They've also published resources, interviewed like experts, and it's like so empowering to actually read that content. And I think that it's very possible for us to do that with other topics related to gender-based violence, but, you know, other topics in general. It requires time, resources, planning, creativity. But my hope is that that's the kind of work that we do, not just in that one news organization, but like in all of them. And also empowering students to do that kind of work. You're right, we do have a lot of problems, but I think that there's so much hope, and there's so many resources in terms of the people in South Africa, the students that we get to see. People really want to do things to change this world, and I have so much faith that we're gonna still do it. And women, I mean, not just women, but women can change the world. It's just about knowing that about yourself.
I think that's like a perfect final statement. Thank you very much. Thank you very much for taking the time for talking to us. I think it was a very, very interesting conversation for me, but also for our listeners. I think we all learned a lot. Yeah, I hope you also had some fun.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Und auch an euch natürlich danke fürs Zuhören. Wenn euch die Folge gefallen hat, schaut doch mal bei uns auf Instagram unter frauensachen-podcast vorbei. Da findet ihr alle Frauen, über die wir bisher gesprochen haben, und verpasst auch keine neue Folge mehr. Außerdem haben wir ein paar von Tandys Veröffentlichungen in den Shownotes verlinkt. Wenn euch das interessiert, schaut da also auch auf jeden Fall gerne rein. Bis zum nächsten Mal hier bei Frauensachen und tschüss.